Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1322. Interview with Paul Blow and Jim DiGenio about the concept of chokeholds. This recorded on March 1st of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiGenio, the author of Destiny Betrayed, and also the person selected by Oliver Stone to write the screenplay for JFK Revisited and the accompanying book, and a prominent place in JFK Revisited, and also on Jim's website, kennedysandking.com, is Paul Blow and his long-running commentary on the JFK assassination. Now, in this talk, we're going to be focusing on the legal concept of chokeholds as it is set forth in the introduction to the book called Chokeholds, and it is about the Kennedy assassination. Now, our audience is familiar with many of the facts concerning the JFK assassination, and that is a topic of discussion that has been presented for decades here. And I myself will readily admit that the concept of legal chokeholds, which is a legal concept and it is derived from the fact that three of the five contributors are authors, and they help to define the concept of chokeholds. So I'm going to rely on them to pin this down, because for me personally, there are so many things about the official version. In fact, practically the whole bloody thing is, as I've joked about, its only real utility would be if you could spread it on one's garden. It would make marvelous fertilizer, because the official thing is absolute nonsense to me. However, the legal concept of chokeholds is one that we will be talking about here, and that we will center on in the discussion. Now, the two of you were networking with some lawyers at a CAPA conference, and they introduced a number of different principles for defining the concept of chokeholds. And but one of those is consilience. And could you perhaps define what is meant by that, and how chokeholds might not mean the same thing to a layperson such as myself and the many people in the audience?
Certainly. Do you want me to tackle that one, Jim, or I can?
Yes, that's why I got my mouth shut.
something, by the way, that I don't find very easy to do at all. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, so look, I think that chokeholds, we'll start with chokeholds. Why we called the book the JFK Assassination Chokeholds. And the subtitle is that inescapably prove there was a conspiracy. So as you know, the word chokehold, you can imagine it being used in wrestling or whatnot. When you have someone in a chokehold, they usually don't escape from it. So what happened in Kappa? It was really interesting. I, for the first time, met the three of the co-authors. I knew Jim for a while because I had done a lot of writing for Kennedys and King, and we held a fantastic event up here in Quebec City with Oliver Stone and Jim coming up to promote their documentary. So I knew Jim and, you know, really like working with him and contributing to Kennedys and King. But in Kappa, the lawyers we met two of the three. A third one joined us after. He hadn't been in Kappa, but he knew one of the co-authors.
I'm going to interrupt briefly. The other three authors are Compton, Matt Compton, Andrew Eiler, and Mark Adamczyk. Those are the other three. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, they're the three, and as you rightly say, they're attorneys. And that was an important, I think, mix of specialties. They're attorneys who knew the law around the JFK Act and also know the case quite well. So Jim and I were, you know, with the research we did throughout, I mean, many, many years, were really well complemented by these three co-authors. Now, the word chokeholds, Dave, comes from Malcolm Blunt. And he used that term when he was being interviewed. I think it was by Alan Dale, but he at the time was describing the way Oswald's file was being administered by the CIA. He presented the information around Betsy Wolf, and Betsy Wolf was a staffer for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and she was tasked with trying to figure out how Oswald's files and files in general were managed by the CIA. And what she discovered with his file, given that he was a defector, he should have had a 201 file open from the get-go when he defected. The 201 file was not open for over a year. And then when information would come in around Oswald to the CIA, it should have gone to the Soviet Russia division. It did not. It was controlled by the Office of Security. Now, what the interpretation of that is that Oswald was being used as a mark card. In other words, the Americans had lost a mole that was uncovered by the Russians, a guy called Popov. John Newman, a great researcher, looked into that and wrote a book about it. And he concluded that Oswald was likely sent as a mark card to Russia, so that when anybody would call in and ask questions about Oswald, there was the likelihood that he was being fed by the Russians. Therefore, he may have been a mole within the American spy intelligence network. So I'm summarizing here, but what Malcolm said is that handling of the file proved that he wasn't a bona fide defector and that it was a chokehold, you know, completely dismantling whatever the Warren Commission, you know, stated about Oswald's persona. So that's where we got the word. And we were discussing this and we were trying to counter the fact that historians still write in the history books that Oswald was a lone nut, or they lean that way, and that the number one source of information was the Warren Commission. So they would completely overlook all the other investigations, the five other government investigations and the civil trial, and they wouldn't even look at that. So what we decided to write about was something that would, you know, compel anybody who would read the evidence that we would put forward, that there are at least 10 chokeholds that definitely prove that there was a conspiracy. Now, the 10 chokeholds we can discuss later, but for instance, I think we all, you know, we very conclusively demonstrate that there was a front shop. So that is a chokehold. We demonstrate in another chapter that Oswald's identity, okay, somebody uses identity at least 17 times, not necessarily the same person, but while he was in Russia, for instance, someone was acting like Oswald and trying to pass himself off as Oswald. And this happened at least 17 times. He's no lone nut. So we have 10 chokeholds that we go into depth to demonstrate. Now, the word consilience Where that came in is, let's take the proof of a front shot. We use the Spruder film to show, hey, look, his head goes violently back. That is likely because of a shot from the front. But there's been so much rhetoric countering that argument that in itself, it might not convince an audience or a listener that that proves that there was a front shot. But then we show the splatter analysis that shows that there's debris, guts, cerebellum, blood that is being splattered behind the limousine, ergo showing a shot coming from the front. Now, then we throw in the witnesses who saw an exit wound in the back of Kennedy's head. So what consilience means is that even if one element on its own doesn't necessarily prove beyond reasonable doubt that there was a front shot, if you take them all and you take everything that is in that chapter, the odds would be infinitely small that there was, there wasn't a front shot. So that's the idea of consilience is that every element of proof adds weight and corroboration to the overall argument, and therefore it becomes a chokehold. So that I would say is where we come up with the word chokeholds and how the concept of consilience is used in the book. And finally, the third element I think you talked about was standards of proof. Interestingly enough, Andrew Eiler, one of the lawyers, analyzed what standards of proof the Warren Commission and the HSCA held themselves to in coming to their conclusions. And basically, they didn't have any standards of proof. Now, in the legal system, there's three levels of standard of proof. There's one that you use for civil trials, and that one is called preponderance of evidence. In other words, you have to show a better argument overall than your opponent. If you go into a criminal trial, you will have the beyond reasonable doubt. In other words, here is that the odds have to be extremely high before you pronounce someone as being guilty. There's something in between the two that is used called clear and convincing evidence. That you would use for a deportation, for instance, or someone, you know, that you would, who could lose his job because of unethical or illegal behavior. So it doesn't reach the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, but it reaches a high level. Those are the standards of proof. That is the standard of proof. Clear and convincing evidence that there was a chokehold for each of the 10 chokeholds that we use, and that the lawyers would tell us when Jim and I and others would write their chapters, they would say, well, what are your sources? What's your argument? And they would say, okay, you know what? I think we brought this to a level that we would be comfortable bringing it to a jury. So that's the concept of the book and some of the terms and guidelines that we abided by in writing the book.
The official version, again, how, for example, would the handling of the rifle per se not necessarily constitute a chokehold? One of the Dallas officials, and I'll rely on you, Jim, or you, Paul, to fill in exactly who it was. But initially, one of the members of the Dallas law enforcement community held up what was a 7.62 millimeter Mauser. And then that sort of disappeared, and they come up with the Mannlicher Carcano. ordered by mail by one Alec Cadell, when someone could have gone in and simply ordered bought a weapon over the counter without producing any paper trail. And the fact that a Mamika Karkana was a terrible weapon to use, and the fact that Oswald was a poor shot and would have to have been firing through a tree to hit President Kennedy. How would that, and I think my query stands, I think many members of the audience, how would that not constitute a chokehold?
Well, I don't think we touched on that in the book, okay? If we did, it was glancingly. But we did talk about this in the film, JFK Revisited.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, up until the coming of JFK Revisited, not very many people examined this issue. Everybody was concentrated on the magic bullet, CE-399, which is a good place. We did have an essay in the book on this, which I wrote. All right. But as far as the CE-139, that is the so-called Mannlicher-Carcano rifle that Oswald allegedly ordered through Klein's in Chicago, if you examine the evidence trail on this, it's very, very questionable, to say the least. All right. And to sum it up as quickly as I can in about five major points. Okay. Number one, Oswald was at work when he was supposed to have mailed it according to the timestamp, the coupon. All right. All right. And secondly, it got to Chicago and to Klein's in world record time. If you can believe it, and it's in the Warren Commission volumes, all right, that coupon went from Chicago to Dallas, a distance of 900 miles, okay, and then was taken out of the post office. The letter carrier went on his route. He dropped it off at Klein's, okay, and Klein's had a sorting system, all right? In other words, they divided up checks and money orders from in-state and out-of-state and cash, okay? They sorted it all out, and they deposited it at the Bank of Chicago in 24 hours. Now, I plead with your listeners. I mail checks in Los Angeles, okay, in the city, that don't get deposited within 24 hours. So the idea that somehow Oswald was going to mail this thing 900 miles, sorted at the post office, sorted at Klein's, deposited at the bank in 24 hours, to me, that's science fiction. Okay, that just doesn't pass the smell test at all, period. All right? Okay, then it's the wrong rifle. Okay. If you, and by the way, this is something that the Warren Commission knew, but they avoided. All right. See, Oswald was supposed to have ordered a 36-inch carbine. Okay. The rifle and evidence found in the Texas, supposedly found at the Texas School Book Depository, was a 40.2-inch short rifle. Okay. Different in length, different in weight. And it's all, as we pointed out in the film, it's different in the way the slings are attached. Okay. If you take a look at the sling on the rifle, it's screwed into the butt of the rifle. Okay. That's not the way that it was supposed to be in there. It was supposed to be at the bottom of the rifle. So there's all these problems with the recognition of that particular rifle. And of course, if you can believe it, the Warren Commission could not find one single person at the post office who remembered giving Oswald like a 5-foot box. Okay. Because, and here comes another problem. Oswald should have never gotten that rifle because he ordered it in his alias name, Alec Heidel. Okay. All right. The post office box was in his real name, Lee Harvey Oswald. So by post office rules, he should not have been given that package. It should have been sent back to Klein's. All right. And of course, the icing on the cake, that wasn't the first rifle that the Dallas police and sheriff's office reported on. The first rifle, was not a Mannlicher Carcano. It was a German Mauser. Okay. So these are some of the problems, with that rifle. And on top of it all, when the FBI tested the rifle, okay, they said it was high and to the right. The sight was not aligned. Okay. So if you're talking about the kill shot, which I believe was from 270 feet away, almost the length of a football field. Okay. There is no way in the world that that rifle could have given you a kill shot from that far away. It would have missed by at least 4 or 5 feet with that imbalance in this. And by the way, there's no evidence that Oswald ever sighted in that rifle. When you
as I recall, Jim, Oswald was, I've forgotten my offhand whether he was right-handed or left-handed.
Yeah, there's a question about that too. There's a question about that. That's true. People try to dismiss that. Yeah. See, people trying to dismiss that, it's actually in the Warren Commission volumes that the sight was misaligned for a right-handed person. Okay. All right. But the point is, when the FBI tested the rifle, they had to sight in the rifle, okay, because it wouldn't shoot straight, all right? See, you have to take a rifle to a gun shop to have it. There's a machine called a calibrator, and that's how you line up the scope with the rifle barrel. Oswald never did that. There's no evidence in the record that Oswald ever did that. Now, Paul's talking about consilience, okay? The idea that the more you pile these things on, the more impossible it gets. Well, if you add in what I just said about that, what the SCI wrote about CE-399, this case would have never gone to court, which I think is a good way to introduce the concept of standard of proof, okay? In any court of law, when you're a criminal court, in California, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Dave, since you live here, there's what they call a 402 hearing. A 402 hearing is a place where the defense lawyer gets to object to the evidence the prosecution is going to introduce in the case. All right. You would have a heck of a time getting that rifle into evidence. You would have an impossible time getting CE-399 into evidence. Okay. But you know something? Here's the ironic factor. If I'm defending Oswald, I want CE-399 in evidence because I want to blow it up right in the prosecutor's face. Okay. All right. CE-399 is one of the most ridiculous pieces of evidence that, the popular name, of course, is the magic bullet. Okay. And in the film and in my essay, what I try to do, I didn't argue trajectory. I didn't argue trajectory. I argued A, the condition of the bullet, and B, the lack of chain of custody. All right. What does chain of custody mean? Chain of custody means that at the scene of the crime, the police mark the evidence down on an inventory list, okay? And they usually also mark the evidence physically itself. Then it gets checked in to the evidence room at the courthouse. Thirdly, when the prosecutor brings it out, he has to sign it out, okay? And go ahead to admit it into court. And then the judge has to rule on its admissibility. Okay. Well, CD-399, how you would ever get that thing in the court is something that is almost too ludicrous to behold. Okay. First of all, the official chain of custody of CE-399 is impossible to prove. And one of the reasons it's impossible to prove is because the FBI lied about it. What do I mean by that? It's in my essay. See, in about June or July of 1964, J. Edgar Hoover made out a list of evidence that was supposed to be used by the Warren Commission. He, in that inventory list, he said that CE-399 had been shown to the first two witnesses who picked it up at Parkland Hospital. And they had approved it as the bullet that they handed in the day of the assassination. This would be Tomlinson and Wright. Okay. Well, Gary Aguilar and Tink Thompson and many other people wondered, well, why isn't there an FBI field report on that? On such an important event. Why didn't the FBI record it? Okay. And so they saw that Bardwell Odom was the FBI agent who allegedly took it to these two guys. So they got in contact with Bardwell Odom and they told him what was in this FBI report, this Justice Department report. And Bardwell Odom said, "What? I never did that." Okay. And I'm sure I would remember it because I was good friends with O.P. Wright. Because he used to work in the sheriff's department in Dallas. Okay. And if I would have done that, I sure as heck would have covered my butt and written an FBI report about that. So in other words, the FBI lied about CE-399. And we have this right from the source. Okay. Now, secondly, if you follow the evidence, the chain of custody, you have the FBI, the Secret Service hands off the bullet to the FBI at the White House. Okay. Then the FBI takes it down to Robert Frazier, the technician at FBI headquarters. Okay. He checks it into evidence. Here's another big problem. How could Frazier check it into evidence before it was delivered to him? Because that's what's in the record. In the record, he says he got the stretcher bullet at 7:30, but the Secret Service did not give it to the FBI until 8:50. See, we have something in the physical universe, as Isaac Newton discovered, called a time-space continuum. Okay? You can't get something before the guy gives it to you. All right? So that's another thing. Now, there's also the interview that Thompson did with O.P. Wright in, I think, 1966. And O.P. Wright, like I said, had worked for the sheriff's department, very familiar with weapons and ammunition. Okay? And Thompson had brought a picture of CE-399. Okay? Which I think everybody listening to your show understands is a kind of pointy hunting round. Okay. No, excuse me. A round-nosed copper-coated bullet. Okay.
And it is pristine. I mean,
right. And it's pretty much intact. Okay. So he shows this to O.P. Wright. And O.P. Wright says, "That's the bullet that they said I handed to them?" And Thompson says, "Yes." And Wright says, "No, that isn't the bullet I handed to them." And he had a drawer full because he was a security officer there. He said, "This is the bullet that I handed to them." Okay. And it was a pointy nose hunting round. Okay. And in fact, according to Thompson in Last Second in Dallas, Wright was so stunned that he kind of followed him out the door. And he asked him again, he's scratching his head. That's the bullet that they said. Okay, so in other words, Dave, this is a perfect example of standards of proof, okay, and chain of custody of what Andrew Eiler and Mark Adamczyk were talking about. In the real world, not the netherworld, the outer space world of the Warren Commission, but in the real world, okay, you would get the case thrown out at this point because for the simple reason that if you can prove fraud, which I just did, on the part of the prosecution, the defense attorney can move to have the case dismissed. Okay? All right. And so this is what Paul's talking about when he talks about consilience between the rifle and the bullet. Okay? And a standard of proof. Okay? And a chain of custody. And Mark and Andrew did a very good job on this, on spelling this out, in that the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee had no standard of proof. There's three generally considered standards of proof, and I'm sure you're familiar with them, Dave. Okay. There is, in a civil case, it's called preponderance of the evidence. You have to prove your case by 51% of the evidence admitted into the case. Okay. The second is usually in administrative hearings, and those are called clear and convincing standard. A clear and convincing standard. The highest standard is, of course, the famous beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay. In which a criminal felony case, that's the standard because you're taking away a guy's freedom. You have to meet a very high standard of proof. Now, Andrew Eiler, a Canadian lawyer who I believe practices in Hamilton, did some research for the book, for the JFK assassination chokeholds. And I believe me, I've never seen this anywhere. I have never seen this any JFK book, and I've read scores upon scores of them, most of which I would have forgotten a long time ago, and I should have. All right. But Andrew did some very interesting research on this. And he went into this whole origin of beyond a reasonable doubt. And he found out that at its fundamental beginning, this standard was instituted not so much for the defendant's sake, but for the community's sake, because they did not want to damage the social fabric of the community by convicting an innocent man. When I read that, you know, I had my antenna go up automatically like they often do in this case, because that's exactly what happened in this case. And this is why the United States has been plagued by November 22nd, 1963, since there was no standard of proof with the Warren Commission. Okay. Or as Andrew shows in the book, also the House Select Committee. Without a standard of proof, you have no authority as to what your verdict is. Okay. So that's one of the things that Andrew put into the book that I have never seen anywhere else.
One of the things that I think I would speak for members of the audience, and this is not in any way to cast aspersions on either of you or your work or any of the other authors of the book or their work. But for example, there are things that for me, not being a lawyer, are absolutely, well, proof of a high level conspiracy that is ongoing. For example, Jefferson Morley has come up with, I believe he was the point researcher, so to speak, noting that the control officer, Joe Anides, who was in charge of the DRE for the CIA, was also the agency's liaison with the House Select Committee on Assassinations, despite the fact that G. Robert Blakey had been assured that the agency would not in any way tamper with the committee's goings on. That basically, if it does not, if that was not made under oath, it would be technically perjury, but it is a lie. And some of the deep politics in the whole thing. Why, for example, would that not be a chokehold? Or, for example.
No, wait, Dave, we did that. See, Paul did a wonderful essay, which is one of the highlights of the book, on the 60-year obstruction of justice in this case that began literally at the very beginning of the case and continued all the way to the ARB. Because I think you know this. The ARB found out that the CIA had a file on Joannides, but the ARB got lied to by the CIA by saying it was only a personnel file. Okay. So Paul did a magnificent job in tracing the obstruction of justice. I think Andrew contributed to that too with the ARB. And that's one of the longest essays in the book, right, Paul?
Well, Jim, if I may, it even goes beyond the ARB. It brings us all the way up to the breach in the law by Trump and Biden, right?
Yes.
So it's really 60 years, Dave, wall to wall. You see, this is covered, the Joannides. I mean, we begin with the Warren Commission, and that is a chokehold. It's called 60 years of obstruction of justice. So if you start with the Warren Commission, the way it was set up, and I think Jim will agree, it ended up publishing a minority report.
Yes.
You know, we know now that at least four of the commissioners did not agree with the magic bullet, for instance. We know that Gerald Ford told at least two people, including Giscard d'Estaing, that he felt there was a conspiracy.
Yes.
We know that Russell, Boggs, and Cooper definitely did not believe in the conspiracy, certainly in the Warren Commission conclusions. But what we do, Dave, in that chapter is we go investigation by investigation, because next we go to the Garrison case. And I think it is so easy to show how this poor fellow, you know, there was so much obstruction coming from Washington to destroy this guy. And this is acknowledged by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. The Rockefeller Commission was a joke. to show how people like Dick Cheney came in to sanitize the report at the end, and that Kissinger was controlling when and where they could have, at least in one case, was blocking Dave Bellin from holding a press conference. Then we go to the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
One second, Paul. I just want to fill in for the audience. David Bellin, or as a friend of mine calls it, David Felon, he was a Warren Commission counsel. And then, you know, wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles, he shows up as the chief counsel for the Rockefeller Commission. Of course, Henry Kissinger was a long-time Rockefeller operative. I'm reminded of a joke that the late brilliant political comedian Mort Saul made. He was one of Garrison's investigators. He said that the political satire died the day Henry Kissinger got the Nobel Peace Prize, which is really quite remarkable. Going to the Garrison, for example, prior to the 27 one-hour series of interviews about JFK Revisited, Jim and I did a 25-hour series talking about Destiny Betrayed. And one of the things that I think a layperson, and I would include myself in this, would cite as proof, well, so much of what was done to Garrison is just unbelievable, and to the witnesses that he had. But Lieutenant Colonel Ray Rooker, who was James Jesus Angleton's deputy chief of counterintelligence and widely recognized as the authority on Jim Garrison's investigation, and he told the Garrison task force that, in his opinion, Jim Garrison would get a conviction of Clay Shaw. And that, I think, is remarkable in the most literal sense of the term. I think if a lay person were to be made familiar with that, they'd say, well, okay, if that comes from Angleton's deputy, certainly someone I don't think we could see as, you know, communist infiltrator or in any sort of nefarious character. Certainly someone who would be acting on the side of the agency in this. That to me is a stunning and fundamental concept. Why would that not constitute a chokehold?
Oh, well, you see, the thing I guess, what's important here is, though many things we talk about have been written about in the past, there's a lot of new stuff though, but it's the way we package the information. So if you take the 60 years of obstruction of justice, the whole Garrison story is in there. So we take each investigation one after the other and we show what steps were taken concretely to obstruct justice for each one. Let me move on in chokeholds for the ARB, for instance. And this was covered in Jim's documentary. But we go over it again in chokeholds. Tim Samaluk of the ARB, what does he tell us? He tells us that the Secret Service, just when they were going to be called upon to hand over all the files around JFK's travels and motorcades in 1963, they shredded them. They destroyed them. Now, what would have that revealed? I think it would have revealed an awful lot of information about prior plots to assassinate JFK that had similarities with what happened in Dallas. We found out that ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, did the same thing. I mean, they destroyed a lady's career who was the liaison. And again, I'm forgetting her name. We talked about it, but she was the liaison who was assigned with the task of handing over and collecting files having to do with the JFK assassination. She was doing such a great job that they had to get rid of her. They derailed that lady's career. And look, every investigation that we look into, it's a 90-page chapter. Most of the chapters, to be honest, are bite-sized. They're written in such a way that your audience will be able to, I think, digest them very well. What we do with the chapter is we begin every one of them with an executive summary. So within a page, we will tell the readers, this is what this chapter will tell you. For instance, we'll say, we'll show you that Oswald was impersonated 17 times, and therefore he could not have been a lone nut. Who would impersonate a lone nut drifter? So we do that. Then we lay out the evidence, and at the end, the lawyers come in and kind of make a summation. Given what we've demonstrated on obstruction of justice, whether it be Joannides or whether it be the Secret Service shredding files or whether it be the destruction of the Garrison case, all of that we go through and we say, given this, we can only conclude they have something to hide. You know, so the way it's written, we've been told by a lot of people, is that you don't get lost in a detail. Like, for instance, you won't debate the backyard photos for 5 hours. You're going to get a chapter, and through what is in that chapter, you will be convinced, we feel, that what we are trying to show, whether it's proof of a front shot or whatnot, you're going to come across convinced. And here's the thing, is you don't have to necessarily be convinced that each chokehold is, you know, correct. Any one of them does the job. Any one of the chokeholds, if we are correct, and we are, you can doubt one, you might doubt two, you might doubt three. I doubt it, but your reader could. But there's no way they'll doubt all 10 areas that we put forth. I think the first chokehold, and I'll just open up on it, but we can get into it later, is a really important one. It's about what is the official record? Now, what do I mean by official record? What do the investigation reports actually say? And what do the people who were involved in the investigation say? What I mean by involved, I mean commissioners, counsel, investigators, lawyers, doctors. Well, in chapter one, we present 90 different people who say things along the lines that, hey, there was a conspiracy. The most obvious one for me is Richard Schweiker. Richard Schweiker was the co-chair of the key committee for the church committee that looked into the Kennedy assassination. And what did he say? He said, I believe the Warren Commission was set up to feed pablum to the American people and collapse like a house of cards. He says that everywhere you look with Oswald, you see the fingerprints of intelligence. And that Tannenbaum, okay, his chief counsel, is just as harsh. And so is Gary Hart. And so is Richard Sprague. So we have all these people and we're saying, look, this is what they told us. And these aren't people selling books. These are the people who had access to what? The classified documents, who talked to the witnesses, who saw the wounds, who were at the autopsy. I mean, when you must know the Seibert and O'Neill story, right? The two FBI guys who are at the autopsy, and they clearly say that shot in the back was too low to come out the throat. You know, so we present that, and anybody who looks at that should come out of that first chapter saying, hey, you know what? The authors are much closer to the official record than some of the pundits that we see on television trying to explain to us, no, the Warren Commission got it right.
What Paul did in that chapter, okay, and did you do that one by yourself or did you have somebody help you on that one?
Jim, this was if you look at many of the chapters, and I'll let you go on, it's a lot of you and my, you know, some of the work we did through Kennedy's and King's, Kennedy's and King and book, but we put it up to date for this book. So I wrote an article about that way back for you, 6 or 7 years ago. But since then, we added so many more insider comments and everything. Same thing with the prior plots, right? That was one of the more popular.
Well, yeah, that was one that you did for Kennedy's and King, and you updated it. But we talked
about the prior plots, too, in the JFK Revisited series of interviews, too. We talked about that.
Yeah, but Paul did a longer one for the – you can only do so much in 6 minutes in a movie.
Understood.
Okay, yeah. But getting back to my original point, see, what was so interesting about this is that these were not, like Paul said, these were not outsiders. These were not writers. These were people who were right in the middle – of these investigations, who were dissidents, who didn't agree with the official story. And when you can line up as many people as we did in that first chapter, well then, come on, you know, give me a break. The official story is, as Richard Schweiker said, was designed to feed pablum to the American people, and he added at the end, for reasons yet unknown.
Okay. So something that Schweiker also pointed out was that Jack Ruby was an FBI informant.
That's correct.
We were not informed of that. And then I recall before the audience, at the press conference, I believe it was on Saturday, the evening of Saturday, November 23rd, Jack Ruby, basically pretending to be a reporter, corrects, is it Henry Wade who says, that Oswald belonged to the Free Cuba Committee, which was an anti-Castro thing. And then Ruby says, no, it was the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
Yeah.
I mean, that for me, and I think for many a layperson, that would constitute a chokehold. I mean, you know,
how the heck did he know that? Because that was the famous midnight press conference,
yeah.
Friday night at midnight. You know, how the heck could somebody in Dallas know that quickly when Oswald did most of his leafleting, almost all of his leafleting in New Orleans at the time? Okay. But Ruby, and you're correct. And we have a chapter in there that was mostly written by Paul about Jack Ruby. All right. And you're right. Jack Ruby was an FBI informant. And this was not found out until Schweiker found out about it for the church committee. And he called a press conference on that. Now, why was this hidden? Why was this classified? Okay.
And the one thing now, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to have to wrap up, and I want each of you to talk about the other material that is available, not just the book, but essays on KennedysandKing.com, and also put in a plug for Black Op Radio. One of the things that I would call people's attention to, and that is in the prior plots analysis that Paul went into and that we covered in the interviews on JFK Revisited, the Fair Play for Cuba committee figures in many different ways in the entire concatenation. And it is one of the things that, if not a chokehold, I think we could borrow perhaps from modern medicine, it would constitute maybe a radioactive trace element that could lead us through the maze of conspiracy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dave, because what we went over, it really should be called similar case analysis, because when I first started researching this, I focused on prior plots. In certain cases, though, I came up with stories and incidents that did not necessarily involve a plot per se, but demonstrated how useful idiots were being used like Oswald and how something could have matured into a prior plot. But here's the key thing with respect to the similar cases that took place not only before the assassination, but shortly afterwards.
We'll almost have a talk. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what we found out is that the, you know, when we looked into the profile, because similar case analysis, right, is a profiling, a suspect profiling method. What you want to see when you look at a prior plot is, well, what are the, you know, what are the fingerprints or what is the modus operandi here? And is there any similarity with what happened with the Kennedy analysis? This wasn't done. It wasn't done for the JFK assassination. And that's why the Secret Service went into, I believe, shredding mode when they were asked to provide information about Kennedy's travels. So let's take one.
We're almost out of time, Paul. I think we'll continue this discussion down the road. One of the essays that absolutely opened my eyes, and I've been familiar with the basics of the case for a long time, that was the Oswald impersonators that Matt Crumpton spoke about. If Oswald was a lone nut, well, he couldn't have been a lone nut. Look at all the people who were imitating Oswald, even while he was in the Soviet Union. So there's no indication that he was a nut, and he sure as heck was not lone, unquote. Both of you have material in the book and also essays on KennedysandKing.com. If you would tell us about that, where they can get the book, and also you both participate in and follow Black Op Radio.
Go ahead, Paul.
Just quickly for the book. First of all, we have a website called JFK Chokeholds.com. So your listeners can go and you know, find out more about the book there.
Can they order the book through that, through the website?
You can order the book through the website. They'll find the links. And the other easy way to order the book is through Amazon, Amazon.com. You just Google on the Google or search for JFK chokeholds and you'll get on the book. It's doing quite well. And, Yes, so both Jim and I are often on Black Op Radio, and we will be talking about chokeholds and other projects. So the other thing, too, is if your audience wants to follow us on Facebook, they'll find that link in the on the website.
And also, of course, there is kennedysandking.com,
yes.
Jim's website, and this material, I've read at length from the book on my Patreon site, but as yet have not introduced it. This is the first treatment of it in For the Record. So there are some websites, there are some other internet radio programs that people can visit for more information, and we will be over time coming back to revisit the chokeholds and the remarkable information developed by our authors and also their three legal collaborators and co-authors. This concludes For the Record program number 1322, interview with Jim DiGenio and Paul Blow about chokeholds. This is being recorded on March 1st of the year 2024. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.